This Frontenas podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The farm-to-table movement embraces locally grown food sources, like seasonal fruits and vegetables, or even livestock or poultry butchered by the grower. This is not, by far, a new concept. Native populations were living off the land centuries before factory farming and mass food production became the norm. Rebel Mariposa is the chef and owner of La Botanica, a vegan restaurant in San Antonio that embodies indigenous traditions from the Gulf Coast, Mexico, and New Mexico. It dedicates itself to deliver food that's respectful of the planet. Beto de Leon, who's Apache and Chicano, is the environmental justice coordinator for the Southwest Workers Union, which works to achieve justice, education, and sustainability for low-income individuals. A native of San Antonio's west side, de Leon's ancestors came from South Texas and northeastern Mexico. De Leon specializes in indigenous herbal practices. He says that though Texas is synonymous with the beef and cattle industry, its roots are tied to the earth.
You know, there were folks that were living here for thousands of years before colonization. So there's a long history of living in harmony with the land and, you know, being not only responsible for what we take, but how we live. There weren't a lot of agricultural societies in South Texas historically, but there was almost kind of like a reciprocal connection between like mesquite trees and nopales and different things that now folks consider, you know, especially people in the cattle industry consider invasive plants, which are actually like, you know, native plants that have been taking care of our families for thousands of years and generations like that.
Well, what are some examples?
Yeah, so like mesquite, I think, is one of the most important ones. When a lot of people talk about indigenous food, they instantly think of corn. But corn was actually shared through trade a lot later in the time cycle in Texas. For the longest time, it was mesquite flour as a prime source of protein for a lot of indigenous people. So they would gather mesquite pods in the late summer and grind them into powder and then either save those powders for atoles or to make cakes or tortillas. But that was one of the most important foods up until the fall when we started having pecans and other things. So it was kind of like living in harmony with what the cycles gave us of the year.
And a lot of people seem to be coming back to the earth. You mm-hmm. hear about a lot of restaurants that are offering seasonal fare. And I know, Rebel, your restaurant does the same. You draw upon that culture in order to bring that food from centuries ago onto today's plates.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to do that here. I think in other cities, people are a little more used to restaurants having more seasonal menus or, you know, their upscale restaurants can have them, but to do it on, you know, something that's more affordable is not as common. And so for me, it was really important to start to shift that change within the community and the culture to go, look, let's think about what's in season. Let's think about what's in harmony and kind of understand that restaurants might not always have the exact menu 12 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. And we don't do drastic changes, but we do some things to slowly integrate that idea and that practice of eating in more harmony. And yeah, I mean, it would be great to really have four different menus a year that was working with more like sunflowers when they're in mm-hmm. season, amaranth, persimmons, you know, these things that are more native and that grow wild that, you know, we can either harvest or start to get people to harvest as well and introduce it even into their own home. So when they're cooking with it, they realize, oh, hey, you know, this flower is edible and it's growing wild, you know, in my neighbor's yard and mm-hmm. I can pick it and put it in my salad or saute it.
So how do you educate people about some of these, as Betha was saying, plants that are maybe considered invasive by somebody, to have them embrace it and maybe put it in their cuisine?
I've always been into like really wanting to motivate people to eat vegetables, right? And so what I started to do on my Instagram account was just take videos of me picking things from my garden and eating them and not saying anything, just like eating a piece of kale that's growing in my garden. And now I'm picking this wildflower primrose that was growing, those little pink delicate flowers that are out right now. They're actually now dying back, but they were in bloom for the last couple of months and they were everywhere all over San Antonio. And so I picked it and I ate it, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that was edible. And I was like, it's absolutely edible. It's super medicinal. And if you look it up, you can see all these benefits. Now, you don't want to overeat it because it's medicinal. So it's like, you know, if you ingest too much medicine, it's not good for you. Just little things like that, putting something on the menu, but also just personally showing people through social media, because that's a big outlet now these days to get people to see what is out there. So something just as fun and simple as that is just like putting it out on a picture or a video of going, look, I'm picking this flower or this leaf or this loquat or kumquat, you know, and I'm just going to pop it in my mouth. A lot of that knowledge that Beto was talking about that, you know, comes from hundreds and thousands of years, it's been super suppressed and it's now making its comeback.
And people who are of an indigenous background or are Mexican American, they know just from their past, from, you know, their abuelitas or their great grandparents and the parents and the great grandparents who came before then, that there are generations of these herbal traditions. You have this yerba that you take when you have a stomach ache, or you have this when you have a susto. And I'm sure, Beto, you've probably looked into a lot of the herbs that are involved in this and maybe the history behind them. And I know a lot of people wonder, how was it that people from hundreds, thousands of years ago, that they were able to know that these herbs worked for that particular purpose? And I have to imagine it's all trial and error.
As far as I've heard from many of my elders, like, it really was just kind of our ancestors learning by trial and error what helped, different things. And I guess there's also a tradition of also sympathetic association, where they see a plant that might look like it connects to a certain part of the body, and then kind of seeing if that was something, or watching what the animals ate, what the animals foraged for, and knowing that it was edible. There's different herbs that, like, the bears will dig up in the spring. So kind of keeping an eye and watching what nature was also connecting with, too, was the way that our ancestors started connecting with different medicinals.
So here in South Texas, what would you say were some of the herbs that were more popular amongst the indigenous population?
And there's still things that are pretty popular now. I think, like Rebel was saying, we've had so much of our traditional wisdom kind of suppressed, but we kind of start poking around, asking elders in our family, they still remember how to use, like, cenizo to make tea for the throat, or epazote used to be a really popular plant for deworming, but it's also a really good plant to make beans with. And estafiate is really good herb that grows all over San Antonio and South Texas, and it's also really good for lower intestinal problems, too.
And a lot of these herbs are also used in cuisines,
yeah,
right?
Yes. Yes, elevated cuisine, right? That's like, it's like, makes me cringe a little bit, right? Like, when these spaces can use these herbs and it's fancy. Yet when people, when it's part of their lineage, indigenous people, native people to this land, to this country, want to use it in their cuisines, it's looked down on, or it looks like it's poor people's food. And so just making sure that we're not keeping it classist in a way, right, where we let, you know, these elevated cuisines use all these herbs, yet people who've been connected to these plants for thousands of years can't even have access to them or grow them. So that's why it's really important with La Botanica that we do that as well, that we're like just slowly introducing people to herbs and spices and different things that they aren't accustomed to. Maybe they're not going to eat it raw yet, but just go, look, this is just what it looks like. This is what it kind of tastes like. And just open yourself up, you know, and maybe that sounds like hokey and all that, but, you know, it's 2019. I think people are starting to realize, you know, the power of intuition and indigenous knowledge and connection to the earth, and that things are living and vibrating all together. We need to, like, shift our consciousness to open up a little bit more to realize that.
You touched upon it right now, Rebel, where a lot of people don't have access to fruits and vegetables and herbs, which is something that lower income individuals used to have, because they would actually, you know, grow it themselves, or they'd have some sort of a community garden where they would share amongst themselves. But that's no longer the case. There's so many food deserts here, especially in San Antonio, where people have more access to hot dogs and processed food and Snickers and sodas than they do to actually, you know, a banana. So if you could maybe talk to us a little bit, Beto, about your efforts in food justice.
Yeah. So I live on the west side, and we have a lot of problems with diabetes. We have a lot of problems with access to affordable healthcare and programs that really help take care of the community. And I think what we're really trying to undo is you know, hundreds of years of colonization, how it's impacted our bodies. And now, you know, things that maybe 50 years ago would have been seen as junk food are so common now. They're not any fault of the community, but more of a fault of cheap product sources like flour or corn syrup or things like that. And the kids want Takis instead of, you know, growing corn. So like, at, I think one of the biggest pieces that we see now is that we don't have a connection to where our food comes from. And so because we don't have that, we don't really know what's going into it, how good or bad it is for our bodies. And like Rebel was saying, you know, it would be really awesome to kind of reconnect and relive with the seasonal cycles and the seasonal offerings of the earth. But for a lot of folks, when poverty has already taken such a huge toll on our families and our communities, that might not be the first thing we think about when we go to the grocery store. It's, you know, we're trying to get what we can afford to feed our family for the day. And sometimes that might not be the healthiest food. And oftentimes it's not, because it's always the cheapest food. And I think for me, where I kind of started taking a little bit more of a serious look at my food was listening to my mom. She would just tell us stories about being a migrant farmer also as a kid. And they were like, you know, we couldn't eat what we were picking from the fields. So we would have to eat snakes from the creek, or we would get mesquite pods from the trees and we would eat that. You know, for her as an Apache and Chicano woman, she was connecting with the foods that had taken care of her grandmothers and her ancestors. But just listening to her inspired me to start connecting and thinking, like, maybe food doesn't just come from the grocery store. It doesn't just come from the garden. Maybe there's something there to just listening to the wisdom that our families have. And that's where I started kind of thinking, like, food justice needs to be more of a deeper conversation, because we're so used to what TV and consumerism and capitalism's taught us that we've broken away from those kind of like traditional foods too.
I have stories, you know, similar to Beto, where my father, and he's, you know, one of 12. I grew up where you would have a meal together, and there would be beans and tortillas, and there would be the yellow cheese. And the thing is like, they would tell stories about how they were so poor that the government would give them flowers and give them the cheese blocks. And so there you go, you're making flour tortillas now, and you're shredding the orange block of cheese to put into your a quesadilla or to put with your frijoles. It's everywhere. You see it in all the Mexican restaurants. Well, but let's talk about where that came from, right? Yeah. Like, that was, you know, forced on our people from the government. That was, you know, yes, there was no more slavery, but you still have people working at, you know, slave wages and labor, forced labor, you know, and continued to kept down in poverty. And then giving them this unhealthy food that was in surplus, right? And going, oh, it's okay, just give it to the poor people. You know, and when you really start to understand and read, again, like the history and look into things, you kind of start to see the cycle of why and how things have shifted, and understand that it is very much a class and a race thing as well. And people who are at the top want to stay at the top, and they need people to do the work. They don't care if you're unhealthy. You know, we had pictures of Selena, you know, with Coca-Cola. This is, you know, back in the day, right? But when you see it now and you think about it now and you read about it now, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, the impact of having a picture of Selena holding in Coca-Cola. Oh my gosh, look at our icon, this beautiful woman, this Chicana Tejana who's singing and connecting to us, and she's drinking Coke. Okay, I want a Coke, right? So I think like understanding that and then kind of allowing ourselves to disassociate with it and go, you know what? I don't want to drink a Coke anymore. Yes, it tastes good, but it's not that healthy for me, mm-hmm. right? And there's other things where I can get sugar source. I can have some fresh sugar cane. I mean, have you ever sucked on a sugar cane? I mean, it is phenomenal. You know, I would take a fresh sugar cane over a Coca-Cola any day, every day. And so I think when we can just like help to connect people back to the source, to mm-hmm. plants, just like where you're picking it up, you know, from the tree or your garden, and sharing that, it will really help people kind of open up again to what is already there. Or lineage. I think that there's something that can awaken from that when you taste something that maybe someone was eating five generations ago in your family.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to know that we have to be like responsible with the information we share, because, you know, for some folks, this is about returning to the food of our grandparents or food of our ancestors. It's very important. Like, everybody's indigenous to somewhere, and you can connect with those flavors without having to take something that's not yours or claim something that's not yours or trademark something that's not yours. But understanding the people that are doing it, understanding the community around you, you can support them in different ways without owning the flavors that they have been, you know, caring for hundreds of years.
We've been speaking with Beto de Leon, environmental justice coordinator with the Southwest Workers Union. He's Apache and Chicano and a native of San Antonio. We also talked with Rebel Mariposa, an indigenous woman who's chef and owner of La Botanica, a vegan restaurant in San Antonio that embodies indigenous traditions from the Gulf Coast, Mexico, and New Mexico. To hear more of our conversation, log on to tpr.org. When we come back...
And I wish people would realize that the preparation of Mexican food is, it's detailed.
And if anybody knows anything about Mexican food, traditional Mexican food, it's Diana Kennedy. A collection of her papers is now housed at a San Antonio university. That's coming up on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. One of the largest collections of Mexican cookbooks in the nation recently received a donation of archives, letters, and rare Mexican cookbooks from a doyen of traditional Mexican cuisine. Diana Kennedy has often been called the Julia Child of Mexican cooking, but that description doesn't go far enough. She's not a celebrity chef. Kennedy has spent over 5 decades traveling throughout Mexico to unearth the country's unique cuisines and preserve them for posterity. Kennedy's collection of 19th century cookbooks, personal papers, and photos are now part of a Mexican cookbook collection at the University of Texas at San Antonio. The 96-year-old British native traveled nearly 900 miles from her home in Michoacán to hand-deliver her archives to the UTSA Library's special collections. Dean Hendricks, Dean of Libraries at UTSA, says Kennedy had been shopping around her collection to other cities and universities, and San Antonio came out on top.
San Antonio is a crossroads. You know, the border has crossed us several times, and this region is tightly connected, obviously, to Mexico. And so when Diana heard about how we've been incentivizing faculty to use the cookbook collection to teach Latin American history or history of Texas, I think that piqued her interest.
Amy Rushing, head of special collections at UTSA Libraries, says the collection doesn't only contain her observations and documentation of her travels.
Scrapbooks, correspondence, some correspondence with famous chefs like Julia Child, letters that people have written to her, sort of fan letters. There's documentation of Prince Charles's visit to her home.
Ven a comer, which translates as come to eat, is a fundraiser inspired by UTSA's Mexican cookbook collection, which consists of around 1,900 cookbooks, some of them dating back to 1789. Diana Kennedy's collection is its latest edition. This year's Ven a comer fundraiser honored the self-described ethnogastronomer. The nonagenarian says her encroaching mortality inspired her to consider preserving her legacy.
I'm getting old. You see, I'm 96, so I've got, and I've been almost 50 years in Mexico, so 7 books since then. So it is an awful lot of material, and I don't think I'll live very much longer. I'm trying to make it to 100, and have to recognize that if something happened to me, what would happen to all these things? So some of them will go after my death, my culinary library, for instance, which I use all the time. But I have some lovely 19th century Mexican cookbooks that need to be under special care and special climatic conditions. I live in an ecological house, you know, in Michoacán, and of course there's no control of climate. And we're about to enter another rainy season, so as you know, what happens to the old paper and print of these books.
And preservation is a costly process. Leah Rios, a project archivist at UTSA Libraries Special Collections, says Kennedy's classic cookbook collection presents the biggest challenge.
Each of them are about, they're about like over $1,000 each to either get the pages cleaned, replace the book binding, or I don't think any of them have mold.
No.
But it's still expensive to redo the book binding because you have to take, you know, unsew it, resew it. So that's like a real specialty and it's very expensive.
And digitizing the books runs another $2,000 to $5,000. Kennedy says no one item in her donated collection stands out to her, but they bring to mind the one constant companion that transported her to markets and homes across Mexico, her trusty Nissan double cab pickup truck.
Nobody has driven all over that country like me. Everybody said, oh my God, you know, your truck, how old is it? Well, actually, it's now 19 years old, but it still goes, and it still is my pride and joy. And I always say I wish it could talk, because we've been through floods and landslides and all sorts of things together. This, I think, will see me out. I would love another 5 years. And it's got history.
Kennedy says if anybody walks away with anything from her writings and her culinary research, she wants it to be a respect and proper treatment of the traditional ingredients.
Now, and I wish people would realize that the preparation of Mexican food it's detailed. Most people don't bother. I do, and I'm always saying, oh my God, they didn't do something rather, or they put garlic in their guacamole, which they should never do, or something like that, you know. So I'm a bit of a scourge, all right?
The Frank Talking Scourge's Legacy will be available for research at the University of Texas at San Antonio once the cataloging and preservation work are complete. Until then, no garlic in the wok. Got it. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz, and our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.